single-handedly carrying out the green transition. Is that right?
No.
No, not in New Jersey. In New York. In
it's in New York. Okay.
Yeah, in Brooklyn specifically. Yeah, single-handedly doing the green. I tell you, it feels like more and more we need that green transition. I was. I don't know if you've heard, we're in a heat wave again out here.
I've heard. Yeah.
And I guess this is the start to the show. Welcome everybody, Jason Smith, back for his third time. I think at this point you become our official political economy correspondent.
I think
Wow, sorry, I hate to tell you.
I don't
you
know if it's three, actually. I was thinking about this earlier. I think it might be two. I think that we might have had a, I could be totally wrong, but I thought we might have had an occasion that didn't happen or something like that. But in any case, man. I know we've done it at least once. So yeah.
Maybe that one appearance was so powerful. It feels like a couple of them. But yeah, you're back, and we're going to talk about demographic transition. We're going to talk about fertility. We're going to talk about a Marxist political economic analysis of this to try to get away from people like, I don't know, Alex Jones and Elon Musk, who are freaking out about this shit, and all the post-fascists rising in Europe to deal with this shit. But yeah, no, on the green transition stuff, Jacob had the space wrong, the place wrong. I'm working in New York right now. I'm working on the green transition. It was so hot today out there, and unfortunately we have to record on a work night for me, that our vibratory hammer we're using, this $1 million 7-ton machine, this powerful machine, just like quit at the end of the day. Which on the one hand it's like, oh no, that sucks. On the other hand, it's like, okay, I guess we're done for the day. So the machine itself, like the actual like capital, the dead labor, has
right,
a limit.
Dead labor.
Right. Like we reach our limits, and so does the dead labor.
What is this vibratory hammer? Like, that sounds incredible.
Oh, it's cool, man. I mean, I would I'd show you videos and stuff, but we're just on Zoom right now. It's basically like this big giant, looks like a platter, and it goes up vertically in the air, and it's got these jaws that clamp down on steel of some sorts. In this case, it's giant sheets, and it literally like jumps up and down like this. The motor system, it's all it's all hydraulic, and it just pounds things, vibrates them into the ground, man. It's great fun. Great work. Good work if you can get it. You definitely need headphones though. And my God, the fucking weather, dude. If this episode comes off a little flat, it's because like my brain is boiled all day. But I've been drinking lots of water. We're here to talk about demographic decline. We're here to talk about your new article, excellent article out in Brooklyn Rail, which is like your publication with Paul Maddock. You published.
Yeah, it turns out that it's. I think Jacob and I were talking about this. I think Jacob has published 11 pieces over the last decade, and I think I've done 12.
So
that's a lot. That's a lot, you know. And they're long pieces too, right? I mean, they're like oftentimes 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 words, and so it's a lifetime.
It's a lifestyle, really. You're actually the political economy correspondent for the Brooklyn Rail, and Jacob is the philosophy correspondent, I suppose.
Yeah, well, Paul Maddock notwithstanding. Right?
Yeah, fair enough.
We offer him the chair of political economy, it's incredible context to be writing because of Paul and because of the other writers. Phil Neal's another person, Jamie Merchant, a number of other like really great writers. And so there's just a lot of space, and Paul's like really a great editor. And so I'm really happy to have had the opportunity to write for the Brooklyn Rail. I mean, that said, I mean, this piece is really, really long. I'm sure that many people that are listening haven't read it and maybe won't read it, but I apologize in advance for the length of the piece. And in part, that's because Paul really encouraged me. You know, I really had this idea that I would sort of try to write something and then really compress it into something manageable, but he thought that was a bad idea.
No,
so
he said, go all out with it. Go crazy with it. I don't think it's overly verbose. I don't think there's too much in there. As somebody who is like very much an amateur on these questions, I thought it was really fascinating because, as I sort of alluded to in the beginning, demographic transition is a real thing, right?
And yeah, for real, yeah.
There are large elements of the ruling class who at one point 50 years ago were freaked out about overpopulation,
exactly,
now
yeah.
freaked out about underpopulation, right? Declining fertility rates across, let's just call it the core capitalist world, An inverted pyramid now of the people who are quote-unquote productive and work,
right.
And those people, those scroungers and moochers, those pensioners,
exactly.
who are living off the lifeblood of the young, who take up more and more of a percentage of a ratio of modern capitalist economies. So this takes the form of appearance of a crisis of
right.
capitalist society, capitalist civilization, certainly of capitalist nation states. And what your piece does really well, and before we go on, I have to name the piece. It's in Field Notes, of course. After the wave, winter, demographic decline and the production of men in the 21st century by Jason E. Smith. In your piece, you take this issue, which I think a lot of people on the broader left are afraid to touch because,
right.
of course, it's tied into movements of people, migration, certainly populisms, mostly right-wing populism, which is trying to address this issue in, of course, not just natalistic ways, but also racist and xenophobic and chauvinistic ways, as there's a large mismatch these days, it seems, or a growing mismatch between the centers of population growth and the centers of capital accumulation. So
right.
you actually provide not just a Marxist account, but you go back into the classical political economy with what Adam Smith was talking about with the production of men, this commodity of right. quote-unquote men, we mean human beings, what Marx said, but then also to somebody like Keynes, who was also trying right. to understand this in the 1930s. So talk a little bit about your inspiration for this piece, and we'll take it from there. Why did you come up with this topic?
Well, first of all, that was an excellent sort of overview and synthesis of a lot of the paper, actually. So I really
thanks.
Appreciate that. I did want to say that, you know, I was thinking about this a little bit earlier because, you know, in some sense, I'm not sure exactly why I decided to write on this question. I think some of the questions that you've already addressed or at least raised are responsible. It's certainly in the discourse, typically in a kind of ideological form, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of preoccupation within kind of like political discourse around populism, immigration, and on the right, in the far right, oftentimes a sort of sense in which these demographic questions are kind of framed as questions of whiteness or kind of national identity, but also they're kind of framed as kind of gender, a kind of crisis of gender, right? Sort of crisis of masculinity, crisis of the family, and so on and so forth. So all this stuff is sort of in the air. And unfortunately, I am on Twitter. And so I pick up on a lot of this sort of ambient discourse, which
it's
is kind of
X
interesting.
Now. It's Elon's world.
X,
you have to
excuse
start,
me.
Yeah.
yeah, give me about 5 years and I'll come around to it.
Yeah, right. Might take longer
for
me. But yes, there is on Twitter, as you say, there's like a discourse, like an ambient discourse
right, exactly.
around it.
And you try to avoid it, but you pick up on it, right? Like, and it's certainly, I would say it's kind of inane, a lot of it, but on the other hand, it's kind of symptomatically interesting. So
yes.
there's that part of the question. And I'm certainly interested in some of the more kind of gender-oriented interrogations of this broader question of demography, which we can get into maybe at some point. But I think probably the true sort of source of interest, of my interest in this question was just reading like, you know, the sort of paper of record, reading New York Times, reading the Financial Times, and trying to get a sense of what the elite discourse is, as opposed to the sort of, let's say, kind of ambient popular and even populist discourse. And those people, whoever they may be, are also totally preoccupied with this question, but not for ideological or for sort of cultural reasons, but for economic and political reasons, also often specifically geopolitical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably the point at which I thought, you know, there's something kind of interesting here going on in the discourse, where on the one hand, there's this sort of cultural discourse, which is quite interesting and funny, and again, inane in a lot of ways. But then there's this kind of much more focused preoccupation of the political elites and the capitalist class that takes the form of these kinds of this kind of panic over the kind of economic consequences of population decline or fertility decline and so on and so forth. And for whatever reason, that seemed to me to be the kind of trigger for saying, oh, I can write about this because these people care about this, right? Like, whereas like, I don't typically want to enter into the kind of larger cultural miasma around these questions, although of course they're very, very interesting for reasons I've already pointed out. So
Yeah, and we can maybe towards the end of this talk about the, you know, the practical effects of this. I think your idea of starting with elite opinion is a really good one, and maybe that's where we should start with here, because you know, maybe when I was younger, I would read the Financial Times or the New York Times, especially because it's our hometown paper here,
Sure.
with an eye towards like understanding the world. Of course, now later on, it is of course a way to understand the world, but more importantly, it's a way to understand the way that understandings of the world are curated
Right.
by tastemakers, by opinion makers, by elements of the ruling class and people, you know,
Right, exactly.
stenographing for them. And we, you and me and everybody out there can take a peek into like what they understand as important issues and how they frame them, what they include and what they exclude. Of course, no issue, no topic being more pertinent over the last year or so than the war in Gaza, which has
Absolutely, yeah.
shown an incredible, I think, disconnect between everyday people and even events on the ground and what we're meant to think. What, you know, the New York Times especially is, in a sense, the ruling class working out their ideas and talking to one another. And we see very
Definitely.
clearly what that means there. So there that they find it important, I think, is enough for us to find it important. And the
Right.
fact that it's such a topic that's so imbued in controversial discourse, let's call it, and
Right.
nationalism and chauvinism means that we ignore it at our peril. Because as you point out in the article, there are actual laws of motion to this. Like it is connected
Right.
to the mode of production, the mode of social reproduction that we live in. And these changes are ones that Marxists or communists, whatever, need to get their head around, because we have to have A, compelling explanations for it, and B, like compelling politics that arise from the confrontation
Right.
of this. I'm a humanist at the end of the day, and I don't mean that in a philosophical way. I mean that in just like my personal moralistic way. Every human being has intrinsic value just because they're human, because they're individuals, because they're people with a consciousness and a subjectivity, and they're important because they're people. But like, so it raises even sticky questions of like, what does this mean for the future, not of capital, but like of humanity? Like,
Oh,
what
for
is,
sure, yeah.
are more people in the world more better? Is there like a utilitarian politics that comes out of this? Or do we need to understand this as like kind of a force of nature until humanity is actually able to take the reins of our own production and reproduction and choose these things not on an individual level, but on a social level? And now that I'm done with my soapboxing, talk a little bit about I don't know, maybe about that, maybe the difference between like the moralistic humanism thing and
Right.
like the sort of dry mode of production stuff. Like what's the
Well, that
intersection between those?
yeah, I mean, these are well, one of the other terms that we could sort of introduce, which I do not discuss really, I think at all, and it's partly by design because it's such a big, you know, sort of chunk to sort of take on and chew on, but the kind of ecological aspect of
Yeah.
population growth. And of course, you mentioned that the great panic of the early 70s and really the whole post-war period up into the early to mid 70s was a sort of environmentally inflected sort of neo-Malthusian discourse about
Right.
overpopulation and the capacity of the planet to bear X number of humans. And it was a very sophisticated sort of cybernetically sort of generated model that sort of wanted to that produced a kind of discourse around the so-called population bomb. That was the famous book by Paul Ehrlich, which got a lot of sort of airtime, probably because of that title. And it, all of this was sort of, you know, mediated by these kind of geopolitical concerns about China, I think, as much as anything, you know, and that's something we can come back to a little bit, because I think that's something that's sort of just beneath the surface of a lot of the contemporary discourse.
Yeah.
But I did, so let's say that the kind of missing piece in my account, of course, is the kind of environmental question. And I think that actually, or the ecological question, and that in some sense touches upon this kind of humanistic problem that you're raising. So that's the first thing I'd point out. The second thing I would suggest is that, you know, Marxists, you mentioned this earlier, that leftists and Marxists, let's say leftists more broadly, have a kind of slightly uneasy, if not phobic, relationship to sort of addressing or posing questions about demography. And that's a really interesting and long tradition that sort of really maybe traced back to Marx himself. And it's something that I think you find, you know, sort of occasional complaints about this within the kind of on the left or within the kind of Marxist left, particularly from people like Marta Jimenez is one person that comes to mind, but Wally Secombe is probably the author that I rely on most and for whom I've learned the most about these kind of questions. And so I think that that's something that we also should start out by just announcing that that's a problem among Marxists and on the kind of Marxist left in particular. That being said,
I would add one thing to that because you do mention social reproduction plenty in your piece, is that this demographic decline thing really does, I think, for a lot of leftists, for good reason, threaten one of the things that we hold very, very dear to us, which is the emancipation under capitalism of women, women's reproductive freedom and autonomy and ability to enter the labor market and all that stuff. So it immediately puts that block up, I think, for a lot of people who don't, who there is seems like there's some correlation between those two things, and they don't want to touch the subject because they don't want to feel like they have to give up on women's rights.
Right, totally. And that's a very significant sort of thread to sort of pull on, because within sort of not only in Western Europe or the North America, but even in, for example, South Korea, which I cite at one point in the paper, there's a very sort of high level, minister level discourse that blames essentially women and feminism for, you know, declining fertility rates and declining ultimately sort of absolute population growth. And so that's a kind of fundamental sort of thread that runs through this question, which again, as you say, sort of like, requires on the part of those of us on the left or those of us who are Marxists or those of us who are feminists, it requires a sort of, I don't know, kind of a framing of the problem so as to not be caught up in that kind of discourse, right? On the other hand, you can say that, you know, one of the Marxist critique, or excuse me, the feminist critique of Marxism from the early 70s and since has largely focused on kind of the day-to-day reproduction of the commodity labor power rather than this kind of generational reproduction or replacement of entire generations of laborers. And so that's something that's also worth noting, is that, of course, there's a vast, I mean, literally libraries full of work on this question, but if there is a kind of point of emphasis, it's on that day-to-day reproduction of labor power as a commodity rather than these kind of larger secular trends.
Sure.
And so so that's something that is worth sort of noting or kind of footnoting as we move on. But I do think that that's something that, I mean, you address the issue within Marxism is that Marx's whole account of population dynamics is largely staged as a polemic against Malthus,
right,
and for whom he had utter contempt on many, many levels, even though there are certain aspects of Malthus's discourse or his method, let's say, that he sort of picks up on. So I think that's important to remember, that in some sense it's a question of staging a kind of theory of population growth or population movements, which is kind of emphatically anti-Malthusian.
Yeah.
And so as a result, there's a kind of a long tradition, basically, that's, what is that? It's 150 years now, of people avoiding demographic questions by saying, well, of course, anyone who poses or thinks of kind of historical transformation and change and historical dynamism through the framework of demography is in some sense conceding a kind of Malthusian starting point, right?
So right. And people will go, of course, further too when it comes to political questions or political economy, when degrowth, for example, comes up. And
right.
I feel
exactly.
I've said this before on the podcast, but I feel like growth versus degrowth is kind of like not even the point. And I don't really engage much in that because it's about like overcoming the relations of production, which would presumably overcome our entire conception of what growth or degrowth is. But, you know, without going down that fucking tangent, right? Like to posit that human beings need to be like conservators of the earth, or that we need to like reconnect with like the natural sensuous nature of ourselves, which is nature in a certain sense, will elicit accusations of neo-Malthusianism, Right. As though growth is like this force of nature that can't be stopped. And the only thing you can do is be Malthusian about it. Like, for people who don't know, I don't know what people's familiarity with Malthus is, Thomas Malthus. In your piece, you, like, of course, address him and talk about him in the negative, the critiques that Marx had. But he was like a liberal philosopher, but he was also, his theories were basically pre-capitalist. Like, Malthusian theories work. Right. In a period of proto-capitalist,
early
capitalist, like rural agricultural relations on the land, and they completely fall on their face. And there's a good reason for Marx to reject them. And you talk a lot about absolute versus relative surplus value and stuff. But like Adam Smith, of course, who Marx is much more sympathetic with, is also an anti-Malthusian in a sense, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, so at one point, just to clarify that you sort of addressed just now, is that, you know, it's interesting that in Western Europe in particular, you see this really kind of this kind of trend upward, and ultimately a kind of dynamic trend upward in population growth only maybe second half of the 18th century. Mm. Right. And so Malthus's first version of the essay is like, you know, the famous essay on population is from the that's like 1797, something like that. There's later versions that he wrote in response to criticisms and that sort of thing. And so it's probably I think there's a third version that's from the 20s or something like that. But all of these writers that we identify as classical political economists are writing basically in the period between 1776 and 1820s. At a point at which population growth as a kind of secular trend is just taking off.
Right.
And so that by the time you get to Marx, let's say 1860s, 1870s, that pattern had been established and sort of taken for granted in some sense. But I think that for those early writers, Smith and Malthus and many, many others, it's like a fundamental question for all of those writers. They're coming to grips with what for them is a kind of unprecedented historical trend, right? And they're trying to sort of understand what the meaning, what the kind of social and historical meaning of these kind of this sort of population boom, as it were, which would be sustained for, you know, two centuries. The thing that I sort of, as you mentioned, I sort of skate around Malthus in part strategically because there's just a huge sort of abyss of writing around that. You know, Malthus and the critique of Malthus and so on and so forth. Although in some sense, it's probably wiser to take these things on straight in a kind of straightforward way. But part of what I was trying to do was revisit Marx, particularly for people who don't know where Marx talks about his theory of population, sort of capitalist mode of production's population structure. Or dynamic. It's chapter 25 of the first volume, and of course, people who are familiar with Capital know that's a very, very difficult chapter, and it has lots and lots of different layers, and it's in some sense one has to sort of reconstruct in some sense his theory. At least I found that to be the case. Mm-hmm. And when I was trying to do that, I ended up thinking that, well, you know, in some sense the easiest way to sort of clarify what I think is important about Marx's theory is by reading Smith and sort of relating what Marx is doing to Smith rather than to Malthus.
Okay.
So that's why in the course of the piece, I talk about Smith. Smith is really wonderful, incidentally, because it's very clear and it's, you know, sort of written with a kind of rigor, but it doesn't have the kind of theoretical turgidness that sometimes Marx in particular, I have to really, really work through. Yeah.
Everybody does.
All those layers. Right, yeah, right. It's like
part of what makes them so attractive is you can have a Talmudic relationship to a text you've already read like three times.
Yeah, and you have to read it, you know, over and over again, your whole life, which is like a kind of a hideous sort of proposition. But
keeps you in practice. So anyways.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So Adams.
So, I mean,
yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say that. So Adam Smith provides the kind of easiest point of contrast because, you know, Adam Smith's his theory, and there's different ways to think about how he thinks about the relationship between capital accumulation and or the accumulation of wealth and population growth. But the easiest way to think about this is he says that in some sense, population growth is regulated by the rate of accumulation of capital or rate of capital accumulation. So it has no relationship to already accumulated wealth, such that, for example, in China, a very old country with lots and lots of accumulated wealth in the form of roads and canals and irrigation systems and dams and so on and so forth. That's what he means by accumulated wealth, right? Mm-hmm. It's like centuries, excuse me, like millennia, right, of like, you know, buildings and cities and so on and so forth. But his point is that what you see in China is relatively static population growth, precisely because the rate of accumulation in China in the mid 18th century was in some sense a kind of a low growth or stationary economy, right? So that's going to produce a kind of non-dynamic demand for labor, right? So by contrast, in England and also North America, which he sees as in some sense a kind of extension of English capitalism, particularly in North America, it's a very poor country, right? There's no roads, there's no cities, there's no dams. I mean, this is very little in 1776.
Oh, certainly.
Right? I mean, it's just this massive kind of...
it's a backwater.
Yeah, it's a wasteland, right? I mean, it's a kind of massive continent with no build out, as it were.
At least by the Locke-in proviso, you had native peoples, right, exactly, of course, with pretty advanced ways of doing agriculture or whatever, but certainly by like Adam Smith's terms, yeah, it's a wasteland.
Yeah, roads, dams, irrigation systems, what have you, ports, etc. So the argument there is that, you know, even though there's very little accumulated wealth in North America, there's this very, very rapid rate of capital accumulation that produces a demand for labor, which is also going to be a high level of demand for labor. So that will in turn regulate the rate of population growth. So it's a very simplistic kind of correlation, or really a relation of determination between capital accumulation, the rate of capital accumulation, and the rate of change in population size, right? But it gets us somewhere in the sense that we don't think of population growth as a kind of independent variable, right? We don't think of it as this kind of force of nature.
Yeah.
The way that we think of, let's say, like, oh, when wolves, or let's say deer in upstate New York, right? I mean, like, those are populations which reproduce themselves at a certain rate, depending upon usually, I don't know, access to food or whatever it is that, that regulates the size of deer populations. And suddenly you see, you're walking, you know, and you're in the streets of Troy, New York, and you see like herds of deer walking down the street. This is the point that that Smith is making, is that in some sense this is a kind of socially regulated dynamic,
right,
in which population's not a kind of natural force that's sort of overtaking society.
Right. Like, so contra Malthus, who understood like there was a limited amount of fertility of the land, and if you overshoot the population, there simply won't be enough to feed anybody. Very much like an absolute determinant rule, as he says. But even also like Ricardo too,
exactly,
who sees also the land as like the bearer of wealth and the ultimate progenitor of wealth. Smith is, as you say, is like very perceptive about understanding this as a social process, right? What Smith of course doesn't have, which Marx is the one to discover, is the distinction, among other things, between relative and absolute surplus value, right?
Exactly.
So talk a little bit about how that changes, how Marx takes Smith and propels that critique forward.
Well, one of the ways to think about that would be to say that, you know, Marx's critique of Smith would be that, in this particular context, would be that Smith's right, that there's some kind of relation of determination between population growth and the rate of accumulation. But what Smith doesn't seem to understand, or can't understand in 1776, is that capital accumulation is not simply expanded reproduction of capital, meaning that in some sense, it's not simply the kind of growth of capital in kind of purely quantitative terms. There's a qualitative change in the nature of capital itself, or the composition of capital as well, yes, right? So expanded reproduction just means that the amount, the size of the capital grows. And with that, of course, if that is the only way to think about that, then the amount of labor required to carry on and reproduce those operations at a larger scale would be larger than it was. It'd be proportional to the amount of capital growth, right?
Right.
Sorry, I'm putting that in a kind of inarticulate way. But the point that Marx makes is that as capital accumulates, there's also a changing ratio or changing relationship between the amount of machinery and materials and so on that are mobilized in the accumulation process relative to the amount of labor. So effectively what happens is that as capital accumulates, There's more machinery relative to the amount of labor that's used in the in production, and as a result, the demand for labor is less than the rate of accumulation itself.
Right.
And so, as capital grows larger, of course, there in absolute terms, more and more labor is going to be required to carry out production, but less and less labor relative to the size of the capital invested. So and this has all sorts of implications for Marx, which we can get into, but that's the fundamental point that he's making, is that in some sense, there's a kind of break or a rupture between the rate of accumulation, the proportionality between the rate of accumulation and population dynamics. And this has all sorts of implications that are super interesting, but it also means in some sense that Marx can sort of set aside or take for granted the question of population size. Because in some sense, he thinks that the mode of production itself, the capitalist mode of production, doesn't require an external labor supply. But in some sense, it can actually create its own labor supply by introducing machinery into production, which will lessen the demand for labor. Right. So if there's tight labor markets, for example, capitalists can actually introduce machinery, which will actually replace labor. And therefore, that actually increases the labor supply on the market, because there's more and more people competing for fewer and fewer jobs, right? So
yeah.
So
as you say in your piece, the thing that that ends up bedeviling and confounding, let's call them like neoclassical or neoliberal economists, or certainly the power brokers in the World Economic Foundation, right, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the halls of power in Washington, is proletarianization, right? Like the qualitative right. change that happens, the fact that a surplus reserve army of labor is created constantly, and that, say, the difference between Nigeria and China, as you point out in your piece, is a profound one based on like transitory world historical changes within the mode of production. So talk a little bit about like what proletarianization adds to this question.
Well, this is an important question that I think that Wally Seacombe, again, I want to stress that there's an essay in New Left Review, I think it's 1983, called Marxism and Demography. And for me, this is like the real, like, this is like the touchstone for anyone who, I mean, forget whatever I've written, just go look at that essay and try to sort of come to terms with his account of what sorts of criticisms, or what sorts of like sort of emendations or footnotes or modifications of Marxist theory are needed to really understand this process of a proletarianization. But one thing that we can say is that proletarianization is not this thing that happens overnight, right? It's not this thing that happens because one day peasants are separated from the land and therefore have no longer have access to the land as a kind of factor of production. And so they end up in a big factory in Manchester like right. tomorrow, right? It's a very, very complex process whereby that kind of separation, so and that's sort of the, I guess you could call it the negative definition of proletarianization, right? Is this moment of separation right. where peasants no longer have access to land and therefore have to presumably enter the labor market and work for wages. But of course, that's not actually what happens. Like what ends up happening is that, for example, households end up undertaking what Marx called domestic industry or mm-hmm. what we sometimes call cottage industry, right? Where they end up taking on these kind of manufacturing sort of jobs, as it were, that are kind of farmed out to them by kind of these sort of proto-capitalists. And that might involve, for example, making like textiles, right?
Right. The famous one, the putting out system, right?
Exactly. Is that
in the off season of farming, there would be a whole, basically a whole industry based in households, but men, women, and children who'd be spinning yarn just and making money by the piece in order to have enough, you know, to pay their tax bill at the end of the year or pay the rent on their land.
Right. And that's important you mentioned that too, because that's a kind of transitional moment too, where they might still own a small plot of land that they can use to feed themselves or maybe produce some for market or what have you. But there's this kind of transitional moment where on the one hand, they might still be rooted in the countryside and maybe even have some kind of connection to arable land, but they're also involved in kind of like this sort of early production
right.
or early kind of industrial production, in which the fundamental unit of production is the family itself, right?
Right?
And so, so insofar as the family is the sort of unit of production, that means the more family members, not only the wife, But also the children would be involved in production,
right,
and could be in some sense overseen by the father, right? The father would take the role of in some sense the emissary of the capitalist, who provides them with cotton or whatever it is. And in some sense, the kind of intensity of the labor of that sort of unit is governed by the father himself, right? Mm. Directly. And so, this is all very kind of interesting. There's traces of this still within, you know, Europe and East Asia and so on and so forth. It's not as if this is some kind of deep historical past.
Right.
But I think that in some sense, what we see in countries that have not yet industrialized and maybe never will industrialize is that, for example, Nigeria is the example that I cite, in part just because it comes up in this Adam Tooze piece that I was sort of trying to play off of a little bit. But there you have a situation where the percentage of people in the labor pool or in the labor force who are working waged jobs is like under 20%, right? Mm. So but the unemployment rate is like, you know, it's like 5%, 3%, something like that. It's very, very low. So the question is, what are all these people doing, right? How do they reproduce their own households? Well, clearly it's some combination of farming, or a combination of farming and domestic industry, all sorts of services they might provide, right, if they have moved from the countryside into the ghettos, or the kind of large slums on the outskirts of Lagos or wherever. And so in some sense, that's describing a kind of process of proletarianization, which from a kind of Western, or let's say a Western or East Asian perspective, or whatever you want to call it, seems like an incomplete process, mm, right? It's kind of a semi-proletarianization, because many of these workers, in the case of sub-Saharan Africa and West Africa, are not currently working in waged jobs,
right,
with all the sense of like, oh, there's a guarantee, there's a contract, right?
Yeah.
There's a wage, there's a certain amount of security. There might even be some kind of protection against unemployment and so on and so forth.
There might be That's, like a deferred wage in pensions and healthcare. And
exactly.
Things of that,
exactly.
Sort,
yeah. The very best of cases, right?
Like, the best of cases.
Right.
Or at least as we would understand the standard, you know, wage package, say in the United States, even in like the lower end of the service industry, you're at least putting into Social Security, but this is not that by and large.
Right. Exactly. I mean, at the very least, you know what your wage is, right? You're hired at minimum wage for whatever that's $15.50 an hour, depending on the locale. And you have some sense of after working, you know, a month, I will get X amount in return. That's what the wage means on some level.
Yeah.
And I think that what's important is that when we think about wage labor, we have this assumption that that's, what we mean, when we associate proletarianization with wage labor, that's what we have in mind, right? Is that you work for some kind of establishment, there's some kind of contractual relationship and so on and so forth. And that's not what's happening in much of the world outside of Eastern Europe and in, you know, excuse me, East Asia, Western Europe, North America, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, and so as a result, insofar, let's say to take the sort of putting out system or cottage industry model as a reference point, if in some sense the amount of income the family produces depends upon children being involved in production, so that the total output of the unit of production, the family, in some sense is determined by the number of laborers involved in production, then of course you're going to have families that are as large as they can be,
right? Sure.
Right. Because I mean, the whole issue with kind of peasant societies is there is a kind of limitation on the amount of land, right? And so that's in most cases, at least that I'm familiar with, or at least that I have some acquaintance with, let's put it that way, historically, there's typically the scarcity of land in some sense regulates the size of the population, mm, right? So there's this kind of tension between, on the one hand, needing enough people to actually be involved in agricultural production, while at the same time knowing that if there are too many people, then there's going to be some kind of disproportion between the scarcity of land and the population. So that,
right,
kind of implicitly regulates, and it regulates in a way that it's not a cultural regulation of population or fertility, right? It's not that, oh, religiously we want to have a lot of babies, or religiously we feel like three is enough or whatever. Typically there are these kind of material questions which are in some sense shaping what may look like a cultural phenomenon.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. Cause we think of like, oh, well, you know, I mentioned earlier, like the sort of industrial core that you see these low fertility rates. And by that, we mean like under 2.1, which is the replacement rate.
Replacement rate.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right. So basically, like women who are identified according to this kind of model as capable of reproducing and having children, that in many countries currently, particularly high-income countries and countries that industrialized at some point in the 20th century, they are having fewer than 2.1 children, and in many cases, they're having much lower numbers of children, 1.3, like in Italy and Japan and places like that.
Yeah, I saw 0.95, I think, in South Korea. I think
yeah, South exactly. Korea is the lowest. Singapore, South Korea in particular is kind of the
And don't the they aren't they the ones with like a black pill like gamer president too? Didn't they elect like a natalist like psycho dissident right like Redditor guy? I'm just making that up.
Well, I don't know that, but that sounds reasonable given the discourse that, I mean, I know that there was, I think it was a justice minister, for example, who blamed feminism and so on and so forth as like the cause of South Korean this kind of massive collapse, really, of fertility rates.
But you rose, you brought up a very interesting question, which is that, you know, there's obviously this culture war component to the question.
Right, right.
There's a policy component to the question. There's a geopolitical component to the question. But underlying all of that, and this is the really fascinating thing that you're trying to get to, underneath that, there is this sort of these regulatory structures that happen, as it were, behind the back of exactly. The producers of people, you know, it's and then those become expressed in cultural ways, right? These
right.
sort of necessities. And then we can fight and we can struggle about that in the realm of politics and the realm of ideas. But you're trying to get at what is beneath that. What is it within this mode of production that is unique to capitalism, just as other modes of production had unique ways of expressing this, that has led us to this point? Where they say by the end of the century, right, that population will start its absolute decline. Some people say it's going to happen even sooner than that,
I think,
right?
2060s is one projection, right? I mean, I think that's the most the kind of extravagant projection. I mean, come back to the cultural question, because I think this is maybe ultimately what we started there. And but one of the examples I want to give was Mexico, right? I mean, we think of Mexico as maybe a country that still has some connection to religion, to the Catholic Church, and so on and so forth. But even, and it's certainly not the most industrialized country relative to Germany or the US or South Korea, for that matter. But there also, the fertility rate is now at the replacement rate and has been declining very, very rapidly, right? And so, and you can, you know, sometimes people measure it in just in terms of income, but that isn't really quite, that's a relatively abstract and kind of general term. That's income in the sense of GDP per capita or something like that, right? Like, but I did want to point that out because in some sense, what's interesting about the demographic transition model is that there's this kind of universality to it, right? It's like, it's not, so in Korea, it's South Korea, Japan,
Italy,
Mexico,
Hungary,
Italy, right?
Poland, exactly. Poland saw an absolute decline just this last
another
year.
Another very Catholic, very, very Catholic country, right? In fact, it's interesting that the Catholic countries in particular, when you think about Italy and Spain also, I think Spain is lower than Italy and so on and so forth. And so, so that's an important feature because I think that there's a tendency to want to think about this in terms of culture, religion, or some kind of something that sort of detached from these kind of material questions. And I think that, you know, to get back to the question you asked, which is really the big question, which is, I'm not sure I have an answer to, but in some sense, the question is, why is it in particular in the kind of deindustrializing countries, be they East Asia or Europe or North America, have there been these kind of I don't know if catastrophic is the right word, but kind of rapid decline in fertility rates? And that's really the question that I was trying to sort of get at from a bunch of different angles, right? I mean, and in some sense, the question, for me, it's sort of a question of thinking through the history of, for example, the family wage, right? So, I mean, because if you think about it in historical terms, when Marx is writing in 1870, which I forget when, 1867, something like that, whenever Capital is published.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Something
right?
like so that. Let's say 1868, maybe, something like that, yeah.
Right, so let's say 1870 for aesthetics, because in some sense what you find is that 1970 becomes this kind of other sort of historical marker. But when Marx is writing in 1870, you know, it's like the fertility rates in Britain were as high basically as they are currently in Nigeria. And of course, the sort of rate of accumulation in 19th century Britain was much, much higher.
Sure.
The kind of it's a country that had largely industrialized, at least in the kind of the narrow sense that we have of that term, by 1870. And you really only see the decline in fertility rates around 1870. So Marx was living in this moment where he couldn't yet envision something like a kind of rapid decline in fertility rates, nor could he envision, I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, something like absolute population decline. And so the question is, like, what happened between the moment he wrote that and, let's say, 1970?
Between 1870 and 1970, right?
Yeah, something like that, right? Yeah. Because 1970 is the point at which you have this sort of generalized crisis of the capitalist world. You also have this kind of entry of women into the. Of course, women were always working, and even in the high income countries. But yeah. You have this kind of mass entry of women into the labor force around 1970. As well, and then you have these kind of feminist critiques of Marx and Marxism, maybe more appropriately put, in the early 70s, right? At the very end of this kind of model of the proletarian family, the end of the kind of history of that model, which is to say the sort of family wage, right? Yeah. In which you have a single wage earned by the male worker in some kind of presumably kind of industrial workplace and mines or factories or what have you, ports. And that income was enough to support a family of, you know, three, four, et cetera. And why that model became, I guess, hegemonic, because it certainly wasn't in quantitative terms the norm. I mean, it wasn't as if like every family, but that became the kind of model. And it was promoted, moreover, by the labor movement itself, right? Yes. It was a very, very important demand of the labor movement, of the 19th century labor movement.
Yeah, and then it's really borne out with the UAW, you know, and the Treaty of Detroit in the 1950s. Like the aspiration of that, which is sort of aping a petty bourgeois lifestyle, right. Like a professional middle class person, then becomes, for large sectors of the working class, especially the white working class and the advanced capitalist core, goes from an aspiration into like a norm. Whether it's like
right.
The majority of working class families is an open question, but it certainly became normative at that point.
Right, and that's interesting to me. It's like, what does it mean to say something's normative as opposed to just a kind of quantitative reality, right? Like,
right.
Because clearly we have this idea that, I mean, I think in terms of the 19th century labor movement, I mean, a kind of cartoon version of it would emphasize the 8-hour workday, of course, as kind of a fundamental demand and really a site of a real struggle, like really violent struggle throughout the course of the 19th century. And then this question of the family wage also as being a kind of key, and especially the last third or last 30 years of the 19th century, it becomes this kind of fundamental sort of point of articulation for the labor movement. But you also see, and this is coming back to the 1870 question, you also see right around that time, and it's something that's quite clear in some of those middle chapters of the first book of Capital, is there's this kind of pressure from the progressive, you know, liberal elites to impose limits on child labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's a very important struggle throughout the 19th century, and it's not a struggle of the working class itself per se, but rather of kind of enlightened bourgeois elites, right? I think even there's some kind of you know, red Tories, as it were, who were also probably part of that general movement as well. The sense of this kind of kind of paternalistic, aristocratic defense of the working class against the hyper-exploitative bourgeoisie. Certainly with the working day, that's a part of that history.
Yeah, right? Like the sort of decaying good conscience of the, like a decaying aristocratic good consciousness, like a noblesse oblige saying that
exactly.
Our good subjects there, the working classes, should not be, you know, in such terrible dire straits. We need to lift them up by their bootstraps.
But, protect them from national
and military reasons as well too, right? There is like
exactly.
A nationalistic aspect to it. So okay, yeah. So through the from the 1870s through the 1970s, you have this like entire sea change in the way that capital operates. You have like the real, like by the 1930s, a real fixing, 1950s certainly, a real fixing of like class composition, let's say, in say right. the United States or in Great Britain or in France. But you also have, and I think we can see this retrospectively, another aspect of the changing dynamics of capital accumulation, which you write about very eloquently and expansively in your work on the service industry, right? And the right. rise of service work. You have like a vast shift within the economy alongside rates of profit that never, except in outlier cases like China, which ends up carrying right. the world for 20, 30 years or so, you never have a return to the rates of profit that you saw in the past. What do you think about this connection between, and you do mention a little bit service, the shift to service work in your piece, this relationship between population and like the changing, let's say, class composition of advanced capitalist society in the age of deindustrialization?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question, obviously, because like, in some sense, my whole, insofar as I've tried to take a stab at these things, it's all sort of a single crisis, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a single crisis from the late 60s into the 70s and sort of in an ongoing erratic pattern since then. And it manifests itself in all these different ways, right? And so you mentioned kind of the profit rate, the transition to a kind of low productivity, oftentimes low skill sort of service sector economy, the entry of women en masse into the labor force in the 70s, and so on and so forth. And all of these, I think, are sort of, combined with that, to get back to the original point, yeah. Is that you also see in the 70s is when, in particular, kind of fertility rates decline throughout, including in Japan, but throughout the West, right? And so all of these are kind of bound up with this fundamental kind of dynamic of capitalist society, which has these kind of forms of manifestation, which are cultural, dealing with gender, dealing with the labor process itself, dealing with wages and the compression of wages, and so on and so forth. And all of these, I think, are kind of shaping this seemingly kind of secular trend. And so in some sense, I feel like addressing the question of demography in the way that I tried to do a little bit in this paper is in some sense also rewriting another way of thinking about that moment through the lens of automation, service sector, and so on and so forth. I should also mention, just as a kind of a very lazy kind of loop here, that in some sense, when you fast forward to the present and you think about the kind of Financial Times discourse, I mean, a lot of the preoccupation with amongst the kind of capitalist elites with this these population questions revolve around the idea that there's not enough labor supply. Mm. And insofar as the labor supply is static, stationary, or declining, this is somehow going to affect economic growth, GDP mm. growth, or output growth, as you can also put it, with the idea being that and this is a very crude version of this, but in some sense, the only way to think about output growth of the economy is through basically two variables. You have on the one hand, the amount of labor, the units of labor that go into production. And then on the other hand, the rate of, the labor productivity, the levels of labor productivity, right? So if you want to have growth, if you have static labor productivity or stagnant labor productivity, the only way you can grow is by adding more units of labor, right? So longer hours, but also more laborers. And so in some sense, when you read the discourse on population decline or population stagnation within this kind of business paper context, typically the question of automation sort of emerges as a kind of deus ex machina, right? Right. It's like, well, if we're going to have
AI, especially over the last couple of years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen, it's like literally like every 8 years you have this kind of automation sort of evangelism yes. cycle, right? So,
and yet productivity doesn't really ever seem to go back to as high as it was 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Exactly. And it won't, most likely. Maybe there's some kind of miraculous intervention, divine intervention, like we saw the other day. And
maybe they'll figure out fusion power or something like that. I don't even know if that would help. Maybe it would. But I guess it would help in automating a lot more shit. This is all me saying we should head over to the paywall portion, because this is a great conversation. We're at almost an hour right now. So Let's take a little break, you and me. If you're a listener to this, you're not going to get any break at all. We're going to go right back into it. And in the second half, I'd like to get into the political reaction to this. We're already starting to touch on it, but certainly like the sort of post-fascist reaction and the attempts by, say, Viktor Orban or Maloney or others to try to have a pronatalist policy, why that doesn't work. And then ultimately we can maybe wrap it up by talking about some positive political, implications of this for the rest of us who are not just trying to figure this out, but actually like try to defeat this right populism, which is making the world more and more scary all the time. So what do you think? Does that sound good to you?
Sounds good to me.
All right, Jason, we'll see you on the other side. If you're not a patron of the show, patreon.com/theantifada. We'll put a link in the show description, put a link in there for the article and a whole bunch of other stuff that we mentioned here. We'll see you on the other side. Thanks, folks.